Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We do not have a quorum yet, but the appointed hour has arrived. I'm trying to train these committee members to show up on time. My success, as you can see, has been limited, but I'm not giving up. I'm not going to succumb to the urge to start late. We're going to start on time. So
those that are important are here, Chair.
That's thank you, Representative Powell, for pointing that out. We will call the meeting to order when we do have a quorum. In the meantime, we're going to start with Representative Keel's bill, House File 1019. Now, this is just a informational hearing. We do not have the bill in the possession of our committee. We'll be taking no action on the bill, but we will be hearing information about this particular subject. So, Representative Keel, if you'd like to introduce the topic for us this afternoon, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Members, thank you for hearing this. It just so happened that a few of my county officials were here, and so I appreciate the ability to address this committee with the bonding request that we have for our waste treatment site. So it's really, as you hear this, you're going to hear that it's not just Polk County. It's based in Polk County, but it is many counties. And it services a large area, and so I know that you have other plans for the day, so I'm going to let the administrator for this talk about it, Mr. John Steiner, and then we have other county officials here. So,
thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is John Steiner. I'm the Environmental Services Administrator for Polk County up in Crookston, Minnesota. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for allowing us to come down and testify about this bill, give you a little more information about it, and thank you to Representative Keel for introducing it for us. On behalf of our six-county group that we have, which is Beltrami, Clearwater, Hubbard County, Norman, Manoman, and Polk, we're asking for state funding for a portion of the capital costs required to upgrade, modify, and expand our solid waste infrastructure that we have for waste disposal, recycling, and composting in northwest Minnesota. Total project costs we're looking at is $25 million for the entire project. The way it's split out under the MPCA guidelines, it would be $15 million for state funding, $10 million for local funding. Primary partners of the service area for the six-county group covers about 8,500 square miles of northwest Minnesota. Includes a population ranges from about 115,000 to 150,000 people, depending on the seasonal population changes with tourism. And what we're trying to do is capitalize on the investment that the state made back in the 80s and 90s into our solid waste system through grant programs such as this, which are still in operation today. 20, 30 years later, we're still operating those facilities and reaping the benefits of those investments by the state and the local governments. Come to you looking to capitalize on opportunities that are available to us because of the infrastructure we have in place. And we come having done a lot of homework already to try and make this project feasible and shovel ready. We've already done a lot of the preliminary engineering design work. We have quotes on equipment. We have contracts and letters of commitment in place with our core partner counties, with our service providers. And we've done an independent bond review on the project, the financials on it, and have favorable recommendation on that. All in hopes of trying to get bond money last year, which didn't happen. Us, like many other entities, were not lucky enough to receive funding last bonding session. Polk County and our group of counties have a demonstrated history of success with CAP programs, transfer stations, waste recovery, material recovery facilities, air pollution control projects are CAP-funded projects. We know the guidelines. We've worked well with the PCA on executing those and keeping those going. And we have done some innovative things with our projects that do get replicated in other places in the state after we've shown that we can do them. So there's an advantage to funding some of these small projects or relatively small projects for areas of the state like ours. The goal of our expansion project is to further the processing of waste prior to disposal, remove additional recyclable materials out of the waste stream, to increase the recycling capacity in northwest Minnesota and provide for continuation of a source separate organic composting program. We do have one of those facilities. We also provide a lot of service to our public and private waste and recycling service providers and to our residents. You can break our project into five basic components. The first two are based on the resource recovery facility in Foston, which is the backbone of our facility, of our program. The first part would be the material recovery facility. That's actually the equipment that processes waste prior to disposal. We're removing objectionable materials from the waste stream, removing select recyclable materials for marketing. We have, in recent years, converted that over. It was designed to process garbage. We've converted that over to actually be processing some recycling materials for our partner counties, and we would wish to expand upon that. To do that, we need to expand the tip floor area so we can hold more materials to put a second shift on to process them. We need to upgrade some equipment, which would extract more materials and increase the purity of those materials for market. And we need to put another shift on to do that work. The next part of our project would be on the waste to energy side of things, where we're actually combusting that processed waste for fuel, generating steam for three private businesses that depend on that steam for their energy needs. We would look to put in a backup natural gas fired boiler so we can meet their peak demand and sell more of the steam that comes off of our waste to energy facility. Our three steam customers employ 131 employees. In a small town of about 1,400 people, that's a pretty significant volume of the population. We've had all of our steam customers in the last few years come to us asking for more steam so that they can expand and grow, and we've not been able to do that because we can't manage all of their peak steam needs. So what we would like to do is not put in another waste combustion unit. We don't have enough waste to justify that, but just put in a natural gas fire boiler to help them continue to grow and so we don't lose our steam customers. Next component of our project would be an organic compost facility. We have a small one located at our landfill complex, which is between Crookston and Foston, Minnesota on Highway 2. That was put in 2011 primarily to serve Walmart and Sam's Clubs. They had a state initiative back in 2011. There were only two sites in the state, Western Lake Superior Sanitary District in Duluth and Creekside and Hutchinson, that could take that material. We worked with the MPCA to get a restricted permit to operate, but we can't sell that material until we comply with the rules that were adopted in 2014. Because we don't have a firm commitment and a firm permit, because the rules were just passed, we have not been able to offer that ability to our schools, to our higher educational facilities, to our restaurants and other businesses would generate sortable portions of organic material that they could separate out and compost. In order to do that, we would need funding to put in an all-season compost pad and the necessary processing equipment to generate that material, turn it out, and be able to sell it at market. The other two portions of our project relate to transfer stations in our outlying partner counties. The first one's in Hubbard County, which is the Park Rapids area, if you're familiar with that. They have a facility built in the 1990s. They receive about 10,000 tons a year of waste. Right now that waste is hauled out for disposal with no processing. They would like to have that waste processed prior to disposal to remove the recyclables if at all possible. They have a recycling program out there where they depend upon manual sorting to handle the 3,000 tons of recyclables a year they generate. It's a slow and costly process for them. The equipment is aged and is in need of either replacement or repair. And what they would like to do is send that material up to our waste energy facility, up to the material processor to remove those recyclables for them and market them for them, and switch to a single stream recycling program to encourage more recycling in their community. In order to do that, they need to build a new transfer station, and they have to create a layout that allows for a safe environment for the public to drop off their materials. Right now they're seeing on their peak seasonal portions of the year over 1,000 passenger vehicles a day in their parking lot. And that is problematic for operations and problematic and frustrating for the people with gridlock in a parking lot to drop off their waste to recyclable materials. The other portion of our project would be Beltrami County Transfer Station, which is located in Bemidji. It's a privately owned and operated transfer station. It was originally constructed by a local entity who operated the transfer station for the use of the city of Bemidji's residents and surrounding townships. That there was a transfer of ownership on that transfer station later, and due to the nature of their business, it brought in more materials than just the intended area was designed to handle. They have issues with holding materials, getting materials to markets, or at least our market. Their recyclables are intended to come to our facility, be processed, and they have trouble with adequate storage space to handle those. And during their peak volumes of the season, they see up to 1,300 passenger vehicles a day in their parking lot. And it gets to the point where their volume backs up close to Minnesota Highway 197. And if they see continued increase of residents using the program, it would there is a fear of some potential traffic hazards in doing that. One unique thing that Beltrami County wishes to request funding for is a majority of their property in the town or in the county is publicly owned. It's either state, federal, or tribally owned property. It's not taxable. And so to defer those costs onto the tax-paying portion of the county would severely hamper their ability to fund a new transfer station. And so what they would like to do is put that new transfer station at their original site where the county had it when they first started the program, build a new facility and the adequate infrastructure in order to handle the peak demand and handle both the recycling and solid waste material so it can be processed at our facility. I don't know if you want to call.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll ask Kay Mack if she'd like to come up and talk to us.
Thank you, Representative Keel. I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment.
Sure.
We do have a quorum in the room, so I'll call the meeting officially to order. Representative Vogel, would you care to approve the minutes of March 3rd?
Move.
Thank you. Representative Vogel moves to approve the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Minutes of March 3rd are approved. Please go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. My name is Kay Mack, and I'm the Beltrami County Administrator, and I appreciate the committee hearing about the needs up in northwestern Minnesota. And as a partner with Polk County in solid waste, Beltrami County stands strongly behind this facility upgrade project. We are the largest contributor of waste, and the financial impact of the efficiencies that are going to be created in this facility are going to be very significant to Beltrami County as well as to the other five partner counties. It's important to us being the largest, but it's proportionately just as important to all those other counties. The win-win of providing the funding for this project is not only that it improves our financial viability as partnership counties, but it has some very significant recycling impacts, which I see as just a really win-win situation when we can improve financial viability as well as be environmental stewards and increasing our recycling capacity. As John said, in Beltrami County, as one example, 70% of our land mass is exempt from taxation, so we're strapped to do the really good things that we know are out there that could leverage the dollars being used really well. So included in the bill is the county building a new transfer station. The one that is being used is extremely out of date, and the private provider that owns it doesn't have a lot of motivation to invest in that transfer station. And so we'd like to be able to build a state-of-the-art transfer station that can handle our waste for another 25 years. So we respectfully request that the bill be supported not only for what it does for Beltrami and Hubbard counties on a more local level, but really on that very large geographic level. Those counties, when you get up there, they're very large, as you may have noted on the map. So serves a huge geographic area and a significant population. Would you say 150,000 when we...
Up to 150,000 better.
Yeah. So very much appreciate your hearing this and your consideration.
Well, thank you for your presentation. A couple of quick questions. First, list for me again which counties are involved.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, it's Beltrami County, Clearwater County, Hubbard County, Manoman County, Norman County, and Polk County are the primary partners in this. And then the extra capacity we would have, we would offer regionally. So there's other communities that have asked us to process the recyclables for them that we've had to turn down, and other private entities have asked us to process their materials for them we've had to turn down for lack of capacity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Now, you mentioned a local contribution to this project. What was the dollar amount of that?
Mr. Chairman, the dollar amount was $25 million for the total project cost. It's $15 million of state funding on that, $10 million of local funding on that. For most of the project, it's one-to-one funding under the MPCA's guidelines for funding. For transfer stations going to waste-to-energy facilities, the ratio is $3 state to $1 local, which is why you have that disparity. It's not an equal contribution.
Thank you. And Mr. Steiner, you listed the counties that are involved. Are the counties making this local contribution? And if so, how are you dividing up their shares?
Mr. Chairman, the counties are going to provide the local match. It's divided out by their facilities that they would receive. So the shared infrastructure that's owned by Polk County, the material recovery facility, the compost facility, the waste energy facility, is paid for and bonded by Polk County as the owner of it. We have service contracts with the partner counties that will help defray that cost for Polk, so we're paying a prorated share of that. For the transfer stations that are county specific, each of those counties will raise their own funds for that, and whether that would be bonding reserves or tip fee, I'm not sure at this point. That would be up to their local decision makers to make.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Is this a single sort facility, Mr. Steiner?
Mr. Chairman, we are processing single sort materials for Beltrami County. They're in a dual sort system right now. Their transfer station isn't adequate enough at this time to get all the materials to us, so they have some of their fiber materials are going to another location. We are at capacity. We cannot take any more single sort materials until we do some equipment upgrades and we have enough tip floor space to handle the materials to put a second shift on.
And thank you, Mr. Steiner. And just one more question from me about the organics in your overall process. Are you accessing organics from commercial sources and household, or just commercial?
Mr. Chairman, right now we have one primary customer, which is Waste Management and Walmart. They're national contractor, and they just changed contractors in the last couple months at the beginning of the year. So we were tasked originally to help out with an issue they had, which was they could not get the material they collected in western and northern Minnesota to another licensed facility. So the MPCA worked with our facility to construct a temporary separate organic compost facility at our landfill location until such time as the MPCA approved rules for source separated organic composting facilities, which would have the design requirements in it. Those rules were just passed at the end of 2014, and part of the reason for our request is that in order to become a permanent facility, offer that service not just to that one customer but also to the other customers in our area, which I would assume would be mostly schools, universities, and commercial establishments. We would need funding to put in the pad and the equipment necessary to do more than just limp along as we have been doing for the last 4 years.
And Mr. Steiner, that's part of this request.
That is right? Part of this request, sir.
Thank you very much. I believe that Representative Wagenius has a question.
As we are moving ahead with recycling and composting, one of the things that we can do is count that for reducing our climate change gases, and that's all to the good, because that's the thing we have the most control over, and we can chalk that up in the good column. But if we have too much trucking of materials, we can lose the gain we're making. So in your design, are you thinking about, and where you're placing your facilities, thinking about accounting for climate change gases reduced versus those produced.
Mr. Steiner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilginius, thank you for the question. It happens, and it's not based solely on climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, but where the location of the transfer stations are designed so that the residents and so that the commercial waste haulers collecting from your curb or from your point of business deliver to a large transfer facility where multiple loads are aggregated, so we only have one truck pulling them to the disposal or to the recycling facility. Our facility geographically is located almost exactly in the center of our service area. Where some of these materials are going now are distant landfills, so the trucking would actually be substantially reduced from 100, 150 miles down to 40, 60 miles one way. The recyclables that were going, and to indulge you a little bit on this, if you're in rural Minnesota, you really only have two options for recycling. You can either recycle the material yourselves, which is how most of the county's recycling programs were set up in the late 80s and early 90s, or you can contract and have those materials hauled to a processing facility, and the largest processing facilities are located in the Twin Cities. And so by the ability for them to collect single stream materials, bring those in aggregated loads to transfer stations, load them in large volumes and bring them to our recycling facility, you're cutting that mileage down by 100 to 150 miles each way for each load of recyclable materials will be coming to our facility.
Follow-up, Representative Wilginius.
Yes, well, I hope as this goes forward that PCA is actually documenting climate change gases reduced, well, it's that way, and climate change gases produced, so we can show net what is happening with this, because if this is the model for the future, then everybody else has got to be thinking about the same thing as they set up their process, their various levels of what they're doing.
Thank you, Representative Wilginius. I didn't hear a question in there, but thanks for the remarks. And I saw some head nodding back in the PCA row, so I think that's good. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, two questions. You mentioned, Mr. Steiner?
Yes.
That there's a privately owned transfer station. This just doesn't have the capacity. And will your plan, your program, work in combination with his, or what will happen to the privately owned provider?
Mr. Steiner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rombach, the private contractor in this case is located in Beltrami County. They provide services that go beyond Beltrami County's contract as a service provider. So I would assume that if they keep the building, they would continue to provide those services to those other entities that wouldn't be covered under the contract in that building. They also have a fleet that they maintain that building could also be used for. The contract between Beltrami County and that service provider extends beyond the next 1 or 2 years. And so if there was a new transfer station that was funded and constructed under our request, I don't want to speak for Beltrami County, but they do have a contract that would survive that, and I would assume they would work out some arrangement for providing service through the end of the contract because of that change. I do know it has been discussed.
Ms. Mack, would you care to comment on that at all?
I think John's got a pretty accurate picture of what our contract is, and we've got a good contract with a good partner. I don't see that there have to be significant changes to the way that we do business with them. And even when we own our own transfer station, I do not see any reason why they couldn't be a competitor for contract with Beltrami County.
A follow-up, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just comment on the profit? When you're fully operational with this plan, what kind of profits will you spin off?
Mr. Steiner.
Chairman, Representative Runbeck. The profits, I hesitate to use the word profit. As a public entity, we're not designed to make profit, but rather try and be sustainable. And we also would have to pay back our bond debt that we would incur. So I can tell you what we are looking at doing is dropping the tip fee for those partner counties so that we are meeting those margins. I would not characterize as a profit in doing that. Our tip fees at our waste energy facility were $72.50 a ton in 2014. We have additional waste coming into our system now, and we're bringing some additional recyclables in 2015 because of this partnership, and we've dropped our tip fees down to $65 a ton as a result of that. So I would love to be able to answer that question for you, but we're not designed in that manner to generate a profit.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I was just concerned that there would not be additional subsidies required in the future for the operation.
Mr. Steiner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, it is not my understanding we would have additional subsidies that we would be looking for in that. Since 1988, we've operated that facility, and it's been paid for out of the material sales, the steam sales, and the tip fees from the partner counties. All five of the partner counties that we had in 1988 when we bonded for that project are still with us today. We're on our fourth contract, and we've now picked up another county as a result of their commitment when their contract runs out that they would be coming into our system.
Very good. Thank you, Ms.
I have another question, Mr. Steiner. Of your tip fees, is there a percentage of those that goes to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency?
Mr. Chairman, no. The only thing we're remitting to the MPCA is the solid waste management taxes collected on the waste, and that's based on whether we collect it or our partners are collecting and remitting it directly to the state. And so that'd be the 9.75% tax on residential and 17% on commercial or self-haul waste.
Very good. Thank you. I do not see any other questions from the committee today. Thank you for bringing this to us. Representative Keel, did you have any final remarks? Mr. Steiner, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I apologize. I just, for the benefit of some of them that were arriving after we hit it, I just wrap up everything by saying the funding of the project would provide for regional opportunities to enhance the recycling, removing recyclables from the waste, processing more waste from materials in our area, whether it be the Six County Group or with our extra capacity, the surrounding communities. We would be creating that source separate organic compost opportunity for the region. And we would be increasing the access to our programs for recycling, for waste handling and special waste materials like e-waste, appliances, tires, for those constituents in our areas. And so we do need your assistance with that. Our infrastructure is aging. Our systems have grown to the point where the infrastructure is inadequate. And after 20 or 30 years, something needs to be done. And if we don't get funding for that, our programs do tend to continue on this path of becoming more obsolete, in worse shape, and in some cases, certain programs may be in jeopardy. So we would ask for your support in the next capital investment bonding bill that may be offered.
Well, thank you, Mr. Steiner, for reviewing that information. But, you know, it's been my goal to encourage my members to show up on time. So, you know, if they don't get here for the beginning of the presentation, they're just going to have to listen to the tape from now on. Representative Keel, did you have any final remarks?
I do, Mr. Chair. I thank you very much for listening to this, and certainly invite you all to come join Mr. Steiner and the county commissioners in checking out the site. And it was very interesting to see what is happening now up in that area and in dealing with all our waste, all our different types of waste. So anyway, and I would ask you to consider this project in the bonding bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Keel, and thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Next up, we have some reports from the port authorities of Minnesota. And I don't know if they all want to come forward together or individually. I haven't got a plan. But as soon as they come forward, we will deal with that. Thank you. Thank you for joining the Capital Investment Committee this afternoon. We appreciate your being here. I will leave it up to you who wants to go first. Whoever does, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Deborah DeLuca. I am the Director of Government and Environmental Affairs for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I apologize to Representative Hausman, who heard some of this earlier at the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. But thank you very much for having us here and for letting me have the opportunity to tell the story of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I provided you with, I think, three handouts. I hope I remember to refer to them during our talk. So the Duluth Seaway Port Authority has a threefold mission: to generate domestic and international trade, to advance regional industrial economic development, and to advocate for the maritime industry. On a practical level, we are also an entrepreneurial, nonprofit small business. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority owns and manages multiple industrial properties and transportation infrastructure on behalf of the state of Minnesota, most notably in the Clure Public Marine Terminal, which is the only general cargo facility and the only public terminal in Minnesota where small to mid-sized businesses can access international shipping channels to export their goods. Our revenues are generated through cargo handling and warehousing services and property leases. We also represent the interests of 20 private bulk cargo terminals in the Port of Duluth Superior. And I will point out in this brochure, which is all about our Clure public terminal, there, I don't know if you can see what I'm pointing at, but there's a big block of land. And this is the, if you open up first page, this is the Clure public terminal. And next door to it is a project that I will reference. Select AV equipment here. All right. This is the Clure public terminal. And right next door, I'll be referencing this project. This is the C&D dock a little later in the talk. So the Port of Duluth Superior is the largest port on the Great Lakes, and it's actually the 19th largest port in the United States by tonnage. Each year, some 38 million short tons of cargo move through the port by water. I say by water because we are also an intermodal port. We are served by four Class 1 railroads, and that's rare. Most ports are served by one or two. And we move millions of additional tons of cargo through the port by road or rail. This is cargo that doesn't ever even touch the water. We are, however, Minnesota's only deep water international port. It's our state's only direct connection via water to countries in Europe, the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and North Africa. It's only a two-week trip from the Port Authority's Clure Public Terminal to Europe. And I would reference the picture of the St. Lawrence Seaway as it is an illustration to remind you of the passageway from the Great Lakes through the Seaway and then out to the Atlantic Ocean. The Port of Duluth Superior gives worldwide exposure to Minnesota's mining, manufacturing, agricultural, and energy sectors. The Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway system provides a high-capacity, low-cost, energy-efficient mode for transporting bulk commodities as well as heavy lift and project cargoes. What cargoes move through Duluth Superior? Well, let me talk about bulk cargoes first. These are the ones that pour out of a chute, move on a conveyor, or drop out of spouts into a hole of a cargo hold of a ship. These are the cargoes that are handled at the 20 private docks in the harbor. In order of tonnage, these are iron ore and iron ore concentrates, coal, grain, which includes wheat. At this time, that's very market-driven, but right now, past couple years, we've had primarily wheat, beet pulp pellets, canola, oats, and some minor amounts of other grains. Then also limestone and salt. In addition to these bulk cargoes, the bulk break bulk cargoes and project cargoes are handled at our Clure terminal. Handout all about our Clure terminal. If you want to sort of page through, you can see the types and sizes of cargo that we handle. So break bulk is stuff that comes that is handled in individual pieces. It includes heavy lift machinery for the oil and gas production, construction, wind energy, pulp and paper, and power generation industries, as well as the mining industry. It also includes super sacks of grain, of proppant. Anyway, it's stuff that you can lift with a crane and move on and off ships that way. At a time when land transit is struggling to keep up with demand, it's important to recognize that shipping iron ore to steel manufacturing centers in Ohio and Pennsylvania and agricultural commodities to Europe provides a partial solution to transit congestion and lessens the wear and tear on our highways. The port is one of the largest drivers of economic activity in northern Minnesota. Today, the port helps support directly 11,500 jobs and generates $1.5 billion in direct business revenues to bolster the state's economy. Businesses operating in our own industrial development properties or on our own properties employ more than 1,100 people in living wage jobs. Well, how do we operate, and why are we here today to ask you for or tell you why your state money is well used in our programs? We have only a modest property tax levy. And when I say modest, I mean 0.018% from the city of Duluth, which amounts to about $900,000 a year. And we receive some grant funds. But the bulk of our operational budget is self-generated from the revenue produced from cargo and warehousing. Cargo, warehousing, and then property leasing activities. At the same time, we have millions upon millions of dollars worth of public infrastructure to maintain. For instance, it costs about 3,000 lineal foot per lineal foot to build a dock wall, and this is Laurie and Randy can attest to this as well, and we maintain nearly 9,000 feet of dock wall. We also maintain 700,000 square feet of building space, half is leased to private employers and half is available for cargo handling and warehousing. We essentially maintain a micro city inclusive of roads, rail, utilities. The Clure Public Terminal was built over 50 years ago, and much of this infrastructure, including the dock walls just referenced, has a life expectancy of 50 years. So we've already extended beyond that 50-year lifespan. We manage these assets in a way that produces a solid and consistent return for the taxpayer. We generate about $2 million in lease revenues and about $1.5 million in annual revenues from cargo handling. To supplement this revenue, we've received about $20 million in federal grants, primarily infrastructure-related, in the past 15 years. So now I get to the final piece of our funding puzzle, and that is the State Port Development Assistance Program. These grants, which are administered very ably by the Minnesota Department of Transportation, are critical to rounding out our infrastructural improvements and providing the required match for the federal grants that we increasingly rely upon. This program is the final piece, as I said, in our funding puzzle, and Kevin asked me to direct you to the... Each year, the Minnesota Ports Association develops a list of priority projects that are ready to go. These are projects we're waiting for the funding. These priorities are discussed with officials from the Department of Transportation and are ultimately presented to the legislature so that everyone knows what work is needed at each of our four public ports. Our 2015 list was developed late last fall, and I believe you have it before you. We've included it in your packet so you can see what's pending. Our focus today is to tell you about the business activity that will be created if we're able to secure funding to accomplish some or all of these projects. So I'm going to illustrate this for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I'm going to illustrate this with the project that's the subject of our current Port Development Assistance Grant, as well as it's also the first ask on our list for next year. So this is right now we have $2.75 million in grants from MnDOT to support the rehabilitation of what we call Dock C and D, and that's right next to the Clure Terminal in your packet, or in your, in the picture that I pointed out earlier. This is a dock that's been underutilized or vacant for over 20 years, and thereby generating no tax revenue or job opportunities. In the picture, you see some stuff stacked on it. That had to be trucked over from our Clure terminal, and it's just a standby storage area, but it's not. We can't access it by water because the dock walls are inadequate. So it lacked rail and road connections as well, other than a poor quality gravel. The dock wall was crumbled and dilapidated, and the channel slip adjacent to the dock wall needed dredging to accommodate laden ships. The first phase of redevelopment of this dock, In the past, you might see it referenced elsewhere in the materials. It was originally a $16 million project. Now that we have all of our bids in and the project is, we have the contract signed, it's actually a $7 million project. And this will put the dock back into productive use, link it to road and rail, and accommodate heavy lift cargo and a larger variety of cargo types. The project will expand the capacity of the Kluwer Terminal, creating new jobs and additional opportunities to move Minnesota commodities on the Great Lakes and the Seaway. As initially rehabilitated, the first phase of the project, the project represents about a total of 15 direct jobs employed at the site and approximately $500,000 in additional cargo revenues. It's also a shovel-ready development site where new private businesses can invest in Minnesota and create jobs, creating additional warehousing space. When the warehouse is built out, I don't have a figure on this, but it should be about equal. Based on the Kluwer terminal, it should be the revenue should be a little greater than the projected revenues for the cargo handling. When fully developed in the second phase with all the warehouse space, the direct job count will be closer to 45 or 50. The $2.75 million that we've received from the Minnesota Ports Development Assistance Program has leveraged a $10 million U.S. Department of Transportation Tiger Grant and $990,000 from the Department of Employment and Economic Development in the form of a contamination cleanup grant, because this is also a brownfield site, and approximately $3.93 million of our own port funds. Referencing the list that Kevin provided with the projects that the port would like to see ports would like to see funded in the next year, there's only two projects that show up on that for the Port of Duluth Superior or for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, but in reality we have a list of 14 projects ready to go, and these costs sum to over $27 million. Some of these are maintenance projects and some are new construction. Six of the projects have estimated costs in excess of $2 million. Currently, because of the amount of funds that MnDOT gets, we need to return to MnDOT with multiple requests to fund these larger projects. The repavement of Dock A apron, that project in particular is a dock that is going to be put into immediate use, or it's already in use, but it's part of an exciting new project, a new service that we are that we've entered into with a shipping firm that sails out of Antwerp, and I can tell you more if we have time about that. So we're asking for your support of this important program, this important grant program, in the form of consistent funding at a higher level than we currently receive. Note that we're not asking for a donation. We're asking for an investment in the state's port infrastructure. As I've demonstrated, the Duluth Seaway Port Authority can promise to put these dollars to good use to leverage additional private and public funds, as well as economic activity and jobs, creating a solid return. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And I just want to remind you that this is our state's port. Please come up and take a tour anytime. We love to have visitors, and it's a pretty interesting place. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. DeLuca. We'll go ahead with the next presenter. Representative Guinness has a question, I guess.
I do. I'm sitting here thinking about all the benefits provided by the Duluth Port, and everybody accepts that and appreciates it. But there is a burden, and that is that some, not my community, but some communities are having lots of problems with some of the invasives brought in with the ships. I mean, we have the zebra mussel and the spiny water flea, and that's a huge burden on some of our communities. What's your schedule for making sure that we don't see the next invasive in our lakes?
Well, boy, there's so many ways I can answer that.
Well, I'm looking for a timeline, actually.
All right.
Ms. DeLuca, would you care to answer that question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, a timeline. We are already very involved in the issue, if I can answer it this way. We work with the Great Shifts Initiative, which is funded through the GLRI program, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative program, and with support from the Northeast Midwest Institute. It's the only freshwater facility for testing ballast water treatment systems in the United States, and I think of one of only two in the world. And they are working, we've been working at this for a few years to come up with the first type approved treatment system for ballast water, the type approved by the Coast Guard for use throughout the Great Lakes and any freshwater system. It may be useful to point out that since 2006, when the salties, the ships coming in from the ocean, started dumping their water, they essentially switch out the ballast water that they brought with them and shock it with salt water. They have to do that before they enter the St. Lawrence Seaway now. And since that's happened, there's been no documented new invasives found that are coming in through the St. Lawrence Seaway, and that's since 2006. So we are working to address it. There's also an emergency treatment system that's being tested right now with support from the Park Service, as well as Great Shapes Ships Initiative.
A follow-up, Representative Rubinius?
Well, it might be years before we would see a new invasive that has been here for years. So that is not a lot of comfort for probably those folks who are dealing with things like zebra mussels. So it would be important for us to have a very specific timeline, outcomes. When is this issue going to be resolved? So that's what I feel like is missing here. I mean, you can have a framework of 20 years or three, and we don't have that yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Borginius, would you like me to present something to you? Are you asking?
Not particularly. I think it's not me. My lakes have not been contaminated yet, but there are. We just get such heart-wrenching stories from some, both lake owners, but resorts, etc. So it's they who need to hear, not me. To be honest, I'm not the person that needs to hear. They need to hear.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Tice has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, just a comment. When you talked about coming up to see the port, I just realized that I had been there. When I was in high school, my dad was driving truck, and he hauled corn up there in the late fall. And so I would go with him. We would drive up at night and then get in line, and we would sit there and wait. And so I'm sure, because I'm not going to tell you how many years ago it was. But it was quite a fascinating place then. So I can only imagine how much it's changed in those few short years. But it is quite amazing, and it was really interesting to me because being in central Minnesota in the St. Cloud area, we certainly don't see ports like that, and I think mostly take it for granted that that type of activity isn't as close as it is. But it truly is quite an adventure and quite a great, you know, everything is just done so precise. I mean, there is very little cause for accidents. So I was very impressed then, so I can only imagine with all the advances that have happened how great it is. So it would be great to take up your offer to come up and see it. I think it would be lovely.
Well, thank you, Representative Tice. You know, if the leadership gives us a budget, we just might make it. Representative Uglum has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question and also a little experience. Just a few short years ago, I worked on the boats up there in the harbor when I was going to school at UMD. Just wonderful place, wonderful experience, and a great port. But my question is, you touched on the initiatives that are going on with invasive species and the saltwater shocking that is now, I believe, required of every salty ship that comes in. Could you expand on that a little more? That initiative has been around for a few years now, hasn't it?
Ms. DeLuca.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that initiative has been in place, I want to say, since 2006. And what that involves is that they actually empty their ballast water out at sea and then exchange it. It's an exchange it for salt water, and that salt water, the salinity of the water is toxic to the freshwater organisms, and apparently, I mean, I know that Representative Wagenius, some of the references that you made were to inland lakes, and I'm not saying, there hasn't been any documented new invasives coming from the ocean into the Great Lakes through the St. Lawrence Seaway since that time. I thought to say there's not something out there that hasn't been found, but there's been no documented observation, and there had been up to that point in time. There had been regularly observed new invasives up to that point in time.
Thank you.
So was this before or after you worked on the boat and you hauled corn? we won't ask that question. We can't go back that far. Please go ahead with the next presenter.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I didn't see your finger up there, Representative Albright. Representative Albright has a question.
Thank you. I'm looking at this brochure, and I don't have a story, so. But I guess I have a question in terms of over the dynamics since 1959 or whenever the port really became a deliverer of goods and services. What's been the ebb and flow for the taconite as a percentage of the tonnage that is shipped out of the port as would be compared to other products, whether they're agricultural or as you depict in your pictures, whether it be transformers or whatever? Can you give us some idea in terms of what's going out of the port? And I would be particularly intrigued in terms of what percentage that would be consistent of, in a sense, Minnesota-raised goods, i.e. taconite and other things. And is it moving more rapidly than you anticipate?
Mr. Lippman.
Mr. Representative, I'm Mr. Chair and Representatives. I actually have that information in a file in my briefcase, and maybe what I could do would be, because I don't have I've actually brought a spreadsheet so I can reference exactly, but taconite iron ore is our number one commodity. It doesn't come through the CLUR because it's a bulk commodity, so it goes through the private terminals, and there's also a dock in Two Harbors as well. But I don't have the figures for it right in my head to be able to battle off to you. But I could grab them, and while Randy and Lori are talking, and report out to you.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think there are some numbers in this little brochure.
Mr. Chair, that's the current number, and Representative Albright was asking for trends over time.
If you could provide that information to our committee, we'll be happy to forward it to Representative Albright.
Great.
We'll go ahead with the next presentation, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Randy Olson. I'm the Executive Director of the Port Authority in Red Wing, and I'm going to talk just briefly about our current project, and then also our colleagues from the Winona Port Authority are not here, so I'll also talk about their projects as well. The City of Red Wing and the Port Authority have benefited from the Port Development Assistance Program. The investments made to docks and related infrastructure improvements have contributed to business retention, expansion, and the creation of jobs. Nearly 200 jobs are directly impacted by port activities in Red Wing. Commodities that are shipped include corn and soybeans, processed goods such as linseed oil, and products used in the building and trades area. Our current project is the establishment of a dock to accommodate the increasing number of riverboats to our community, including existing riverboats, the American Queen and the Queen of the Mississippi. Last Tuesday, as some of you may know, the Viking River Cruise officials announced the launch of their Mississippi Cruise Service, which will include docking in Red Wing and St. Paul as part of its Minnesota destinations. With the launch of cruise operations projected for 2017, Viking plans to deploy a fleet of 6 new boats over a 3-year period. The specialty built river boats are called longships, and they will accommodate up to 300 passengers. They will launch from New Orleans to St. Paul as a turnaround. Viking intends to replicate its cruise experiences in Europe and Asia by connecting passengers to the scenic landscapes and cultural landmarks of the Mississippi, and in particular here in Minnesota. Red Wing's short-term request includes an additional $1 million for an expansion of a dock to accommodate the increasing number of riverboat traffic, and then $1 million for improvements to the adjacent land. Viking's presence in Red Wing is timed to complement the city's planned River Renaissance project, which has been in the works for many, many years. The city's River Renaissance project is the implementation of a planned riverfront improvement, which includes improvements to the road, which is adjacent to the Mississippi River, the extension of the Cannon Valley Trail along the riverfront, and numerous upgrades to shoreline walls along the Mississippi. And plans are underway to begin this summer. The cost of the River Renaissance project will total nearly $8 million, and those funds have been secured through federal and state government sources and also state legacy funding. Several weeks ago, we met with representatives of Viking River Cruises, and they were impressed with the plans that are in shape with the River Renaissance project, and believe that this presence will create a more meaningful Red Wing experience for its passengers and crew. Additionally, Viking plans to organize local educational and entertainment programs that may include tours of our historic downtown, the Pottery District and Museum, local wineries, sites for eagle watching, and they're going to do the same thing in St. Paul. But much work is ahead of us to complete the River Renaissance project and to formalize plans with Viking River Cruises. This is a wonderful opportunity for Red Wing and St. Paul to position themselves as premier river city destinations for both existing and new river boats, and to engage visitors with new experiences to Minnesota. As I said earlier, our colleagues from the Winona Port Authority are not here today, and so I just wanted to share with you that the Winona Port has an aging infrastructure, and improvements to maintain competitiveness are necessary. There are two projects on the list. Include a loading cell project for $250,000. This will assist in maintaining an area for loading and unloading commodities. And a recent engineering report in Winona noted the existing dock facility is deteriorated and will not be functional in 10 years. A second request on the list is an additional $500,000, and this is to improve staging areas in the port area, and this will enable the Winona Port to increase its capacity to ship and offload commodities, which currently are estimated between 1.6 and 2.2 million tons annually. The immediate effect of funding of these two projects will create 7 to 10 construction jobs. More importantly, there are a total of 84 employees with a total payroll of $3.4 million that directly are impacted by port development activities in the port of Winona. So I would be happy to respond to any questions related to the Red Wing request, and hopefully I could also respond to any questions that you may have about the Port of Winona's requests as well. Thank you.
I don't see any questions at this time, Mr. Olson. We'll maybe have some before you leave today, though. We'll go ahead with, I do have a question from Representative Hausman, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because we're on the issue of Winona as well, and Winona was, I'm a real fan of ports and funding for ports, and so the story I often told was about the Winona Port when we had made a significant commitment there. And the newspapers there told the story that allowed them to double the tonnage through that port. And you can imagine doubling the tonnage through the port has an impact on businesses on land as well. And so it's a great opportunity to talk about the impact that ports have to generally the economy of that area. And I didn't know if you might talk just a little more about the impact to what happens in the city.
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the ports in and of themselves, and I can speak about certainly the port activity in Red Wing, but we serve a very defined area geographically. And it's very, very important as we talk to our customers to maintain the existing infrastructure but also improve. We have been told repeatedly, whether it's for commodities or manufactured products, that barge traffic costs anywhere from 30 to 40% less than conventional truck or rail transport. And so, and because of our somewhat isolated location in Minnesota, we could, I think, leverage even more activity from a transportation standpoint with increased investment in our ports. And that's, I think I speak for Duluth and St. Paul as well. We're certainly not, we don't necessarily have the visibility of trains and trucks, but certainly those people that are our customers have come to appreciate the huge cost differential in transport, and they continue to rely on barge traffic exclusively for transport of goods and services from Minnesota.
Thank you. We will go ahead with the next presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. Very happy to give you a few words about our harbor. Wanted to point out the handout here. If you wouldn't mind taking a look at the harbor itself, it has four different areas that are identified there, and I won't read them just in the interest of time, but our harbor, out of about 26 miles on both shores total in St. Paul, our shipping terminals take something like 2.6 miles. So you get a sense of things that way. I would also say that, as we all know, since the Minneapolis Harbor will soon be closing, that means St. Paul, at that point, we will be the northernmost shipping terminal area, the northernmost harbor in the United States on the inland waterway system. And Randy mentioned aging infrastructure, and that's what I'll primarily talk about here in terms of the status of the dock walls and so forth in the harbor. I just wanted to mention on the other side, there's quite a lovely picture here, but actually it's a little bit of geeky information, if you will, Mr. Chair. If you look at these barges actually equal about 12 barges. It's a just about a tow. And I wanted to mention what a tow is. This tow that you're looking at is the largest that can occur on the river in our harbor, and they go down to the Gulf of Mexico and so forth. What is that equal to? What you see as far as commodities in this tow equals 216 equivalent rail cars and 1,050 trailer trucks. So just to give you a sense of capacity in a relative sense. Mr. Chair, also wanted to mention that in this harbor we have about 30 businesses, and that equals about 775 jobs. And dock walls, which I'll talk about a bit here, are very equal to highways. As we see that, these are public infrastructure items that are made, as we call, out of sheet metal, which goes directly down into the river fairly deeply, right on the edge of the water. They're absolutely essential, just as highways throughout the state are essential in order to conduct business. And wanted to mention that point, as well as to say, if you can think back to our history texts, and we all read about the WPA days, the Work Progress Administration, most of our dock walls were built in the 30s. And their asset life, so to speak, if any of us here is an accountant, we know that an asset life is how long should an asset last and have value and productivity. And that's really about dock walls, it's about 50 years. So if you do the math, the WPA dock walls are really suffering, and we have had sinkholes and failures and so forth. Then if you look at some of our newer dock walls, they were built in the 60s. And if you do the math there, that's 50 years. So we really do have aging infrastructure that really needs to stay in place to keep the integrity of the harbor, to keep the kind of international and national product movement in and out of this harbor happening. And also wanted to mention, by way of thanks, we do have one new dock wall, thanks to this program that we installed, that where it never had a dock wall before, in our Southport terminal going downriver from downtown. And want to thank everyone very much for that funding. That was about a $4.5 million dock wall, and that has opened up business. And we have more property that can be used at this dock wall in our Southport terminal, so this is a growth thing. But I wanted to mention Stewart, Minnesota. And if any of you know, one of the major companies in Stewart is Formafeed. And because of this new dock wall, this year yet, Formafeed will be developing a multi-million dollar, 68,000 square foot facility for their organic feed. They have never been in St. Paul before. They are expanding. They are staying in Stewart and expanding so that they can be on the river and apply their trade up and down the river. So we're very happy about that. And there's one example of some economic benefit. So, Mr. Chair, today our priorities on our list are dock wall improvements. But let me say a few more words about other so-called public-private partnerships in the harbor. Commodities, as you may know, as we look at exports from the harbor to worldwide customers, agricultural goods, wheat, corn, soybeans, and so forth, also scrap metal, potash. Coming in are a variety of products: coal, sand, steel, fertilizer, and road salt. So it's a very active harbor. And with some of the other activities, I wanted to mention Gavilon. Some of you may remember their former name, PV ConAgra. And they are located in our Red Rock terminal, which is just about down at Highway 61 and 494. And Gavilon recently completed a $4.3 million upgrade at Red Rock at the facility that they have on our land, which we lease to them. And they added a new offloading tower and associated equipment upgrades. And then earlier, Gerdau, and you may know this is a very large steel mill, which is also located on the west side of Highway 61, so on your left side as you're coming into the city. They invested recently, and by the way, we almost lost them lock, stock, and barrel to Texas. And we found this out through our business development efforts, through our work with the Minnesota State Chamber of Commerce. We were able to save them here, and as a result, they have just invested $51 million in this steel facility, ensuring that good jobs with benefits and a solid tax base continue to be part of St. Paul's and the state's future. So that was a close shave, to say the least. Industry and its spinoff benefits also, as you probably know, offer the easiest access to good jobs and an expanding tax base. We just know that industry is so important for all of those reasons: the wage levels, the tax base, the spinoff effects, so to speak, the economic effects, not just of that one particular company at one particular site, in this case along the river, but elsewhere. We know that even though there are 775 jobs in the St. Paul Harbor, we know that that translates into thousands more with all of the supplier networks and the existing economic activity throughout. Wanted to almost also mention, Mr. Chair, that our river shipping infrastructure is something that we have to maintain, as I said before, so that it's fully operational. And then in terms of what this means in terms of Westway Trading and some of the other businesses that work on an international basis, I'd like to flip your minds for a second to the Panama Canal. You may have heard that although the project is a little beyond, it's probably 2 years overdue, it's going to be very soon now wider and deeper. And the vessels that will go through there are called Panamax vessels. Well, our global companies are thrilled, and you can imagine why, because when barges go south and end up in the Gulf of Mexico, it was a very long haul to get to the Asian markets. And so now with the Panamax vessels, the Asian markets are becoming will become significantly opened to our very own businesses that are here in the harbor. So that economic situation is going to be very significant coming up, we hope, in 2015 yet.
Ms. Lauder, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. Yes. Representative Erdahl has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and more of a comment than a question. I appreciate your reference to Forma Feed, which is located just outside my district, but also happens to be a main wholesaler for a certain dairy processing plant that happens to be in the city of Litchfield. And I'm sure that they are, you know, shipping items to the port from there and would do even more in the future, we certainly hope.
Thank you for that comment. Representative Erdahl, please go ahead with the presentation.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you very much for that comment. As many of you may know, Forma Feed was developed in 1973. It's a family operation. We actually did the transaction with the son of the owner. It might be the grandson, actually. It's a wonderful story, so thank you for your comment.
Quick follow-up.
A follow-up, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you happen to go to their Customer Appreciation Day a couple years ago when they brought in the band Sawyer Brown?
Ms. Mr. Lauder. Chair and Representative, I'm sorry I missed that, but two of our staff did attend, and the stories were quite fun. So, Mr. Chair, to wrap up my testimony, I would also like to mention again and circle back to the Minneapolis Harbor closure. That's an opportunity for St. Paul in our harbor to take some of those businesses, to keep the massive amount of trucks, since they cannot use any longer, in a short while now, the shipping avenue to ship their products from the upper harbor at Dowling and the river in Minneapolis. If we get them down to St. Paul, that's a great opportunity. What that means is we have even a heightened need for infrastructure improvements in the harbor. We do have a few spaces that allow some new dock walls, and as you'll see on our list of capital improvement needs, certainly in Southport and Red Rock, we are focusing on some of the shipping and shipping infrastructure needs and dock walls. So, Mr. Chair, I will stop here. Be glad to take questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your presentation. A couple of questions of my own. First, the Savage port hasn't been included in your presentation today. Can you tell us why?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is a privately owned port and is not a public port. And this program, the Ports Development Assistance Program, is just for public ports.
Thank you. I see that the request here is for $10 million, but you're total estimate is $12 million. Can you all chipping in $2 million yourselves? Or?
Mr. Chair, I wish so. We do chip in on every project, but quite frankly, we've lagged behind in terms of funding. And we hope to catch up, but in the meantime, the realities of business in our ports dictate that we have even more than the $10 million that we could use. I don't know if you got page 2 of the handout, but you can see that ultimately over future needs beyond 2014, there's another $22 million of need. So, Mr. Chair, simply put, we're not on top of our infrastructure, new construction and renovation. We do the best we can, and we're grateful for every bit we get.
That's a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lauder, you mentioned the steel company on Highway 61 down there. Is that the old North Star Cargill steel facility?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, it is. It was purchased by Gerdau Corporation, which is a Brazilian corporation.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, that most people don't realize that we have a steel company in the metro area. Follow-up. Looking at the map here, Ms. Lauder, we have lots of locations, URS, Upper River Systems Fleet locations. I'm assuming that's a private entity. And my question is, what are we doing to ensure competition for in pricing and things for the available facilities that are here?
Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair and Representative, great question. When I got to the Port Authority 20 years ago, there were like three barge companies, and there's been a compression in the industry. Upper River Services, which is run by Lee J. Nelson, the CEO of that company, is our remaining harbor operator. So we do have a 20-year lease. I think we're in about year eight now. That has been a rolling five-year lease for many, many years. And the others left. They just couldn't make a go of it. We did have RFPs out, hoping to keep several. But this harbor is very busy. It has about 5.5 million tons of product going in and out each year, and yet the market has, as I mentioned, had a compression in it. So when you see URS, these are the areas, the yellow hash marks, by the way, are the so-called fleeting areas. Port Authority has riparian rights along these the banks of the river, and then we lease both those fleeting areas and some land as well, known as Barge Terminal Number 2, which is just up on the top part of your map, just across from downtown. And that's about a 3.5-acre site where Upper River Services has their home facility. And by the way, they're creating a new facility we hope that will be open this year yet.
A follow-up for Senator Ugham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Alder, you mentioned the opportunity because of the expanded Panama Canal and, of course, the closing of Minneapolis. Do you foresee opportunity to bring other bargers, other companies similar to URS, into some available areas in the future?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we do, although not exactly like Upper River Services, because they are the harbor operator. They're the ones with the so-called rolling stock. If you go look at the river, well, you see this picture here, they own all the towboats, and they own the barges. However, you'll also see on the front of your the main map here, you'll see something called PBS, Portable Barge Service. A guy named Mike Newman is the owner, founder, and CEO of that company, a much smaller company, but this company is probably only about 8 to 10 years old, and so we do anticipate providing him a continued presence in this harbor for the smaller commodities or smaller level of commodities.
Thank you.
Ms. Lauder, where in the system will the Viking cruise ships land?
Mr. Chair, if you look at Barge Terminal Number 2, and as I said, it's on the right, I didn't say this, but I'll say it's on the right descending bank, as we call it, so it's across the river from downtown. And then if you just look there, I know it's hard because the specificity of the map's a little fuzzy there, but if you can think about right across from there, and so as you would go from the Capitol down to downtown, kind of cascading down the hill, and you go down Jackson Street to underneath the railroad viaduct to the edge of the river. You may know that's called Lambert's Landing. And so there's a fairly significant sized parking lot there, and that's where the Viking will tie up, to the best of my knowledge at this point. We've had other ships in the past. Randy knows the names better than I do, but they have tied up there in the past and taken passengers on and off.
Well, thank you, Ms. Lauder. Now, I know the Port Authority is involved in other properties in St. Paul. Any opportunities there to accommodate this onslaught of tourism?
Well, Mr. Chair, there's a lot going on in St. Paul, as you know, as far as restaurants, neighborhood areas, a pretty decent bus transportation. Downtown is fun, whether you look at a jazz festival in Mears Park or an art festival in Rice Park and the Ordway Theater, and the list kind of goes on and on. Yes, I think people will have fun when they land here.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. I believe it was you, Ms. DeLuca, that talked a little bit earlier about federal matches. Could you describe just what's available from the federal government and how that fits with the proposal before us?
Mr. Chair, as I mentioned, we have a $10 million Tiger Grant for the DOC C&D project, and we can completely see ourselves pursuing something similar for instance, DOC 7, a property that we're in the process of purchasing that's slightly upriver, up the St. Lawrence, I should say, further up the harbor in the St. Louis River estuary that's equal in size. It's actually 31 acres as opposed, compared to the 28 acres of Dock C and D. We would pursue something similar there. We are pursuing, we intend to pursue brownfield grants this fall. Those, for cleanup grants, those have about a 20% match. But, and yeah, all the cleanup money has a 20% match. There's, there are programs to reduce emissions within, for port vehicles and the like, and we can see pursuing those in the next, in the upcoming year. So there's a, we have a relatively new executive director. He came on board 2 years ago, and that is a big objective of his, is to increase our federal grant funding.
Very good. I do not see any other questions from our members. Another comment, Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't inform the committee that we do have a bill for $10 million. It's House File 459. Our chief author is Representative Kelly.
Thank you for that tidbit of information.
Mr. Chair, I should have made one comment. You asked.
Sure. Ms. DeLuca, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you asked Ms. Lauder about the why we are only asking for $10 million if we have such great needs, and we're happy to take more. But I do want to point out that our by statute, the Port Development Assistance Program can fund our projects up to 80% of the non-federal component. And to date, that is only the that program has only been able to fund at least the Duluth Seaway Port Authority projects up to only 35%. The rest of it has been mostly our own money. So that's an partial answer to your question, that the rest of that money is coming out of our own general funds.
So, Ms. DeLuca, when you say our own money, you're talking about the Port Authority itself?
Yeah, the Port Authority funds.
And each of these port authorities operates independently of the other?
Yes, Mr. Chair, each of these port authorities operate independently, and I really cannot speak for the asset account of each of the other ports. But that is our situation, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Representative Hausman has a question.
And, Mr. Chair, I think that has been the advantage they've given us, and that is we don't make individual decisions. We fund a pot of money, and all of you work really well together in determining among you the priorities in every given year, since we never give you enough, that you determine jointly what priorities.
Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, you're exactly right, and I should mention this, and I'm glad you asked the question. We work very closely with MnDOT. And this is a program, should you fund this, that this would go to MnDOT, through MnDOT, and then they administer the proper processes with RFPs and so forth, and then they make the final decisions. We work with them very closely in terms of our technical needs and our individual priorities. And it's been very collegial, I have to say, over the years. There have been some of, I think all of us, deferring to one other port if the money was only this big and we had a critical need. I know Duluth said we'll step aside for a year when we really needed to do our new dock wall. So I just wanted to let you all know that it's a very collegial process, and MnDOT does a very good job of administering this program.
Thank you. Just one more question that's come to my mind. It seems some years ago that there was some problem in the Duluth Harbor with something eating the steel. Is that still an ongoing issue, or have you figured that out?
Mr. Chair, I'm really happy to announce that working with our researchers at the University of Minnesota Duluth, we've actually resolved that problem with a series, we believe, with coatings, with carefully selected coatings. We did a research project testing different panels in the harbor. We have an unnaturally, well, I shouldn't say unnaturally high, because it is a naturally occurring high copper level in the water. And it's actually an anaerobic, you're going to get more from me than you want on this, but an anaerobic process that occurs, that the microbes form these little tubercles that cover the metal, and then it gets scraped off during the ice season. And so the corrosion actually starts to occur in the anaerobic phase, and when it's scraped off, it becomes aerobic. So it goes back and forth. In any event, That's the process that causes the problem, and the new coatings, we think, have it licked.
So, Ms. DeLuca, what kind of creatures are these?
Zebra mussels.
Mr. Chair, some form of microbe. I don't remember the name.
Uh-huh, but you've cured it.
Mr. Chair, I didn't cure it, but yeah, the researchers and the studies that we've conducted in tandem with them.
Ms. DeLuca, here at the Capitol, we take credit for all sorts of things we don't actually accomplish. Well, with that, members, thank you for your attendance today. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.